Good morning. Thank you all very much for being here. And it's great to be back on a campus, and particularly on a Saturday morning, and to see so many students who are here. In my college days, this would still have been an early Saturday morning, and usually would take free food to get me onto the campus. Maybe that's what happened here this morning. But I appreciate all of you being here, particularly those who have traveled from afar, as I did last night from Washington, to scale the mountains of snow. And I know that many of you had to scale those same mountains of snow, so thank you very much. And thank you, Dr. Madsen, for your very kind introduction, as well as for your leadership. As an academic whose research continues the rich tradition of Islamic scholarship, and as president of the Islamic Society of North America, where you have been a voice for the tolerance and diversity that defines Islam. I know that President Obama was grateful for your words at the National Prayer Service during the inauguration. We were proud to welcome you and many others to the White House for the iftar dinner with the president. And I thank you for bringing us all together today, leaders and believers of many faiths, Muslim, Christian, Jew, Hindu, Sikh, including many groups who work together in community service. Thank you all for coming this morning. Imam Latif, thank you for hosting us and for your welcome. As President Obama was preparing to take the oath of office last year, you wrote him an open letter. You spoke of your hopes for his presidency, the hopes of many people. You also wrote that America has rarely noticed that American Muslims, such as yourself, have always denounced violent extremism, that despite the frequent misrepresentations of your faith, you have never lost faith in America, and that, and I quote, we, as American Muslims, are eager to serve our country. To Imam Latif, in your service to Muslim students in the NYPD, to our hosts, the Islamic Center at NYU, and the Islamic Law Students Association, to everyone who joins us today, please consider my presence in acknowledgement of Imam Latif's eloquent appeal. On behalf of President Obama, who asked that I send you his personal greetings and appreciation, I am here to say that your example and your denunciations of violent extremism are not merely noticed, they are celebrated. Your abiding faith in America strengthens and inspires us all. And there is indeed much we can do together to serve our country as fellow Americans. I know that many of you and the organizations you represent engage often with the White House and the Obama administration, not just on issues of foreign policy, national security, and civil liberties that are of unique concern to you, but across the whole range of issues that affect your lives, as they do all Americans, from economic policy and health care to education, the environment, and faith-based community service. I thank you for working so closely with us. And I'm pleased that we're joined today by two members of our White House Office of Public Engagement who work with you every day, Paul Montero and the ever-popular Kalpen Moti. I join you today as President Obama's principal advisor on homeland security and counterterrorism. And I want to thank you for this opportunity to discuss the President's strategy for confronting violent extremism around the world and here at home. And I look forward to an honest and candid discussion about what we can do together to keep our country safe. I also want to thank you on a more personal level for the opportunity to convey my respect for a faith that has helped to shape my own worldview. I grew up in New Jersey, just across the river in West New York in North Bergen of Hudson County. In fact, last night I stayed in Hoboken and woke up this morning to the beautiful view of New York City and the Hudson River, a river that has welcomed countless millions of people over hundreds of years to this great country. I am a product of a Jesuit education, maybe I should say a survivor of a Jesuit education. I attended Fordham University up in the Bronx. You know, that's the school, the Bronx, that you students from NYU couldn't get into. That's why you had to come here to NYU. But for more than three decades, I have also had the tremendous fortune to travel the world. And as part of that experience, to learn about the goodness and beauty of Islam. As a college student in the 1970s, I spent a summer traveling through Indonesia, taking in the wonderful landscape, culture, and people of Java and Bali. Despite my long hair, my earring, and my obvious American appearance, I was welcomed throughout that country in a way that is a reflection of the tremendous warmth of Islamic cultures and societies. Like the president during his childhood years in Jakarta, I came to see Islam, not how it is often misrepresented, but for what it is, how it is practiced every day by well over a billion Muslims worldwide, a faith of peace and tolerance and great diversity. And if you permit me, or I should say, Ismahli, Bad Indonesia, Safarat ila Misr. Wa hunak darast Arabiya fi Jamna Amrikiya, fi Kahira. Wa hada fi elf wa, fi sanat elf wa tismaya wa khamsa wa sabayin wa sita wa sabayin. Wa Safarat ila al-Ordan wa Palestine wa al-Quds and Tunis. Wa Bad Misr, sakin fi al-Shakal Awsit, takriban sita sana. Lakin elan ana ajuz. Ana kunt talib wa shabab lama darast arabiya. Lakin elan nesit aktariyat al-loga. Kislan, lisan kislan. Mutaasif. لكن ممكن إن شاء الله سوف أدرس عربية مرة تانية إن شاء الله عفوا Now don't tell the folks who don't speak Arabic what I said, okay? But I did spend time as an undergraduate at the American University in Cairo in the 1970s. And time spent with classmates from Egypt, from Jordan, from Palestine, and around the world, who taught me that whatever our differences of nationality or race or religion or language, there are certain aspirations that we all share. To get an education, to provide for our families, to practice our faith freely, to live in peace and security. And during a 25-year career in government, I was privileged to serve in positions across the Middle East as a political officer with the State Department and as a CIA station chief in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, I saw how our Saudi partners fulfilled their duty as custodian of the two holy mosques of Mecca and Medina. I marveled at the majesty of the Hajj and the devotion of those who fulfilled their duty as Muslims by making that privilege, that pilgrimage. And in all my travels, the city I have come to love most is Al-Quds, Jerusalem, where three great faiths come together. So much attention is paid to the divisions in that wonderful city, but you can't visit those holy places, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Wailing Wall, the Dome of the Rock, and not know that these faiths can and will live in peace one day, inshallah. I have also seen, as the President has said, how Islam is a part of America's story. American Muslims have enriched every segment of American life, including an area that is often overlooked, and that is our national security. American Muslims protect our communities as police, as firefighters, as first responders, and we're some of the first to respond to that heinous attack not far from here on 9/11. American Muslims serve with honor in every branch of our armed forces. Many have given their lives. And some now rest in Arlington National Cemetery, the crescent moon and star on their headstones, next to their fellow Americans, rightly honored as heroes in the proud story of America's fight for freedom. And American Muslims work to ensure our national security and civil liberties. They are public servants I work with every day. For example, the Department of Homeland Security, Assistant Secretary Arif Ali Khan, at the FBI, Javed Ali, in the town of Kurdism community, Sharik Zephyr, and from the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, Mazan Basrawi. I'm pleased that some of these patriotic Americans are with us here today, and I'd ask them to stand and to be recognized. These Americans, and many, many others, help keep us safe every day from the threats that are real and serious. Among them, the threat from violent extremism. And as we all know, violent extremism is neither unique nor inherent to any one faith. Indeed, violence is something that every faith rejects, but that every faith has had to confront. For we have seen extremists who purport to be Christian murder the innocent in this country. We have seen extremists who purport to be Hindu murder Gandhi and Muslims in India. And an extremist who purports to be Jewish murder Yitzhak Rabin. And we are seeing extremists called Al-Qaeda, who purport to be Islamic, murder people of all faiths. Those of you here today, you understand this better than most. You understand that because you are Muslims, and because you are American Muslims, you have suffered the consequences of this violent extremism in a way that the rest of us will never know. As Americans, you are targeted by Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, just like every other American. Indeed, we should never forget that terrorist attacks on our nation, including the 9/11 attacks, have also taken the lives of many American Muslims, innocent men, women, and children, whose lives were lost simply because they too were American citizens. And had that attack succeeded on December 25th, it could have cost the lives of all those individuals, those innocents on the aircraft, as well as the lives of many innocents on the ground in Detroit, which is home to so many Muslim and Arab Americans. As Muslims, you have seen a small fringe of fanatics who cloak themselves in religion try to distort your faith, though they are clearly ignorant of the most fundamental teachings of Islam. Instead of finding the inherent dignity and decency in other human beings, they practice a medieval brand of intolerance. Instead of saving human lives, as the Quran instructs, they take innocent life. Instead of creating, they destroy, bombing mosques, schools, and hospitals. They are not jihadists, for jihad is a holy struggle, an effort to purify for a legitimate purpose. And there is nothing, absolutely nothing, holy or pure or legitimate or Islamic about murdering innocent men, women, and children. And so devout Muslims like you, as well as members of other faiths, have frequently been forced to defend and define your faith. And this can be especially hard when so many people develop such a distorted view of Islam, because too often, the only time they read and hear about your faith is in the context of Al-Qaeda and terrorism. As families with relatives and friends around the world, you know that it is actually Muslims who have suffered most at the bloody hands of violent extremism. It is your Muslim brothers and sisters from Afghanistan and Pakistan, from the Sahel to South Asia, who have paid the highest price. As one study recently noted, in recent years, nearly all of Al-Qaeda's victims, indeed 98%, have been innocents from Muslim countries, thousands of men, women, and children. And as the Quran reveals, never should a believer kill a believer. And if he does, the wrath and the curse of God are upon him. As parents, it is your sons and daughters, young people the age of students here today, who are being targeted by Al-Qaeda and its hateful ideology. Until recently, some thought that this challenge was for other countries, where Muslims had often not assimilated or been accepted into mainstream society. But as we have seen here in recent months, Al-Qaeda seeks to steal the souls of young people in America as much as they seek to steal them overseas. In this sense, Al-Qaeda is not unlike drug lords, gang leaders, or human traffickers, preying on the confused and the vulnerable, who are perhaps struggling with their own identity and seeking a sense of belonging, brainwashing them with a false promise of paradise and using them instead as cannon fodder for their own murderous agenda. And so, increasingly, American Muslims, mothers and fathers, face the challenge of protecting their own sons and daughters. As communities, you have also been targeted from the other side by inexcusable ignorance and prejudice here in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere. Each of you no doubt, has your own story, many stories. We know that it is not only the Muslim community who has been singled out, but also though perceived to be Muslim or perceived to be different, Arab, Sikh, South Asian. In the wake of the Fort Hood tragedy and the attempted attack over Detroit, we've seen an ugly rise in scapegoating and fear-mongering. Yet the true character of America was on display when Army Chief of Staff General Casey went on national television and said so eloquently after the Fort Hood attack that in our Army and in our America, our diversity is our strength, and our diversity cannot become a casualty of such an incident. President Obama declared in his address in Cairo that he considers it part of his responsibility as president to fight against negative stereotypes of Islam. This is not only a matter of civil rights, it's a matter of our national security, and it's a matter of our morality as a nation. Hostility and harassment toward American Muslims and toward members of other faiths or other backgrounds or other races plays right into the hands of violent extremists. It reinforces the misguided notion that American Muslims are somehow separate from, rather than a part of America. It creates an atmosphere of suspicion and mistrust that discourages dialogue and cooperation with law enforcement. And it increases the chances that a kid growing up in America who is perhaps struggling with issues of his own will become captivated by extremist ideologies. So it is very clear, ignorance is a threat to our national security. Prejudice is a threat to our national security. Discrimination is a threat to our national security. And those who purport to be religious are frequently the most egregious purveyors of ignorance, prejudice, and discrimination, and it must stop. In the spirit of candor, we must also acknowledge that over the years, the actions of our own government have at times perpetuated those attitudes. Violations of the Patriot Act, surveillance that has been excessive, policies perceived as profiling, over-inclusive no-fly lists subjecting law-abiding individuals to unnecessary searches and inconvenience, creating an unhelpful atmosphere around many Muslim charities that made Muslims hesitant to fulfill their sacred obligation of zakat. These are challenges we face together as Americans. And President Obama and his administration are pursuing a comprehensive approach to address them. This approach is rooted in the president's vision of America's role in the world. Since taking office, he has made it a priority to uphold our values and our highest ideals, not only because they keep us true to who we are as a nation, but because they make it more likely that other nations will partner with us for our common security. That's why President Obama prohibited torture and the mistreatment of individuals in custody, and why he remains committed to closing the prison at Guantanamo Bay. The president has made it clear that we will define our country not simply by what we are against, but by what we are for. The opportunities, the liberties, the common aspirations we share with people around the world. Rather than simply focusing on ties between governments, he has pursued a broader agenda and engagement with people on issues that are most important to them: economic development, education, health, good governance, and the dignity of every human being, including the fulfillment of women's rights. We see this in his outreach to the Muslim community around the world. He is the first person to use the inaugural address to speak directly to Muslims. He has spoken to people directly in his interviews on Al Arabiya and on Dawn TV in Pakistan, in his message on Nowruz, and of course, his speeches in Ankara and Cairo, where he pledged a new beginning with Muslim communities based on mutual interest and mutual respect. And this weekend, the president is addressing Muslims from around the world, including representatives from some of your organizations, in videotape remarks to the U.S. Islamic World Forum in Doha, where Secretary Clinton will be attending. He's reaffirming the commitments he made in Cairo, including his unyielding pursuit of peace between Israelis and Palestinians. He's highlighting the many new partnerships that he promised in Cairo and that have already begun, initiatives to promote economic development, education, science and technology, and public health. And in a sign of his continued commitment, the President is announcing that a member of his White House legal staff, known to many of you, Rashad Hussein, will serve as a special envoy to the Organization of the Islamic Conference. This same spirit of partnership is needed to confront the challenge of violent extremism. And the President's approach has three main components: defeating Al-Qaeda and its allies, confronting the broader challenge of violent extremism generally, and safeguarding our homeland in a manner that both protects our security as well as our values. First, defeating Al-Qaeda and its allies. The President has been very clear about who we are fighting. We are not waging a war against terrorism, because terrorism is but a tactic that will never be defeated any more than the tactic of war will. Rather, such thinking is a recipe for endless conflict. We are not at war against terror, because terror is a state of mind. And as President Obama has said, as Americans, we refuse to live in fear, and we will not. Rather, we are focused on defeating and destroying Al-Qaeda and its violent extremist allies. We are at war with Al-Qaeda and its extremist allies, and any comment to the contrary is just inaccurate. We will destroy that organization. And that is why President Obama is responsibly ending the war in Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11, and all U.S. troops will be out of Iraq by the end of next year. At the same time, the President has refocused the military mission in Afghanistan, targeting the Taliban insurgency and protecting the Afghan people, increasing training of Afghan security forces, and beginning the transfer of responsibility to those forces in summer 2011 so that American forces can begin to come home. Today, the core of Al-Qaeda, led by Osama bin Laden, is seriously damaged, bloodied, and hunkered down in the tribal areas along the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. We've taken out key leaders and made it harder for them to move, to raise money, recruit, train, and plot their bloody attacks. We've disrupted many more plots and saved many more lives than the American public or the press will ever know. Nevertheless, Al-Qaeda remains adaptive and highly resilient, with a web of affiliates distributed throughout the world in places like Yemen, where Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula took credit for the failed attack over Detroit. In Somalia and East Africa, the Sahel and North Africa, in South Asia and in Southeast Asia. So in partnership with countries around the world, we're using every tool in our toolbox to protect our country and our citizens, going after those murderers wherever they plot and train, sharing intelligence and building the capacity of partners like Yemen to defend themselves, disrupting the financing that fuels terrorism and working with law enforcement. At the same time, we recognize that there is no military solution to the second and larger challenge we face of violent extremism generally. This includes those upstream factors, the political and economic causes and conditions that help to fuel hatred and violence, including loss of faith in political systems to improve daily life and the vulnerability of young minds to predators like gangs and terrorist recruiters. And while poverty and lack of opportunity do not cause terrorism, it is obvious that the lack of education, of basic human services, and hope for the future make vulnerable populations more susceptible to ideologies of violence and death. Ultimately, these challenges require political and economic solutions. So in Afghanistan, we're investing in leaders who combat corruption, promote good governance, and improve basic services, including education and health. Across the border, we're partnering with the Pakistani people, investing $1.5 billion every year for 5 years to promote economic development and strengthen democratic institutions. And finally, we are doing everything in our power to protect our homeland. And just as Muslim Americans serve at every level of government, local, state, and federal, to keep our country safe, let's never forget that Muslim American citizens, you and your organizations, help keep our nation safe as well. This too is frequently lost in the hysteria and fear-mongering that often surrounds national security discussions. In the aftermath of the tragic murder of 13 Americans on an army base in Texas, Muslim American organizations roundly condemned such senseless violence and in fact reached out to help and support the family of those victims. We read about arrests such as the Lackawanna Six in Buffalo, but forget that it was Muslim Americans, community members, religious leaders who helped bring such plots to the attention of authorities. We read about the cases such as Somali Americans from Minnesota returning to fight in Somalia and five Virginia men who went to Pakistan seeking out militancy. But let's not forget that it was concerned parents and families worried for their loved ones who frequently alerted authorities. In other words, keeping our country safe and protecting our sons and daughters from hateful ideologies demands trust and cooperation. Over the years, organizations represented here today have worked closely with our government in this regard. Going forward, I would suggest that several key principles can guide us as we meet our responsibilities to each other. First, and I believe foremost, government must fulfill its responsibilities, including protecting the rights and civil liberties of all Americans. For the president, who worked as a civil rights lawyer and as a professor of constitutional law, this is not some policy choice to be debated. These are core values and laws that must be upheld. We must remember what we're fighting for. As the president noted in his State of the Union address, the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department has returned to its founding mission, protecting civil rights and prosecuting violations. This includes the rights of Muslims, Arabs, Sikh, and South Asian Americans. For the burning of a mosque in Tennessee, several individuals will spend many years in prison. Across the country, the Justice Department has gone to court to protect the right of girls and women to wear the hijab to both school and work. And I can assure you today, the Obama administration will vigorously enforce new hate crime laws, because the United States of America, no one should ever have to hide their faith out of fear. Second, your government must listen to you. Security policies and procedures cannot be formulated in a vacuum. They must reflect the realities of the world in which they will be implemented. Law enforcement cannot lose sight of the people that it is sworn to protect and to serve. We may not always see eye to eye, and I'm sure we will have differences as we discuss these issues today. These are very difficult and complex issues, though. And frankly, we within the government struggle with them on a daily basis. They do not lend themselves to easy answers. And at times, we are unfortunately forced to make some painful decisions that we would not make under ordinary circumstances. But on behalf of President Obama, on behalf of this administration, I can promise you this: in every discussion, in every decision, civil rights and civil liberties are always a priority. For example, in the wake of the attempted attack over Detroit, we strengthened our no-fly list, focusing on those who might do us harm, not those who don't. From the president on down, we are doing everything in our power to protect our national security and civil liberties, as we do not believe we need to make a choice between the two, and we will continue to optimize both our security and our civil liberties. Third, even as we listen and work together, we cannot securitize the relationship between the government and the American people. Not only cannot, but we should not. The relationship between the government and millions of Muslim, Arab, Sikh, and South Asian Americans and your government must not be defined by the threat of violent extremism. That is exactly what the terrorists want, and it would risk reinforcing the dangerous notion that your communities and your government are somehow in conflict when and not we are fellow citizens facing a common threat and need to find common solutions. Fourth, our work together must respect the proper roles of government and community. Government, law enforcement, and counterterrorism at the local, state, and federal levels should focus on keeping our country safe by preventing and prosecuting illegal behavior, including terrorist activities. And as experience has shown us, this is most effective when done in partnership with affected communities, because you know your communities best. The separate task of countering radical ideologies, the beliefs and attitudes that can lead to violence, must be led by families and communities, including your organizations. Government can play a supporting role, as is the Department of Homeland Security, in partnership with some of your organizations, but communities must take the lead. I commend your efforts to reach vulnerable individuals, especially young people, through religious education, social programs, and the internet and social networking sites. But I want to say a word about the internet. Just like gangs and drug dealers have infiltrated our neighborhoods and our parks and our playgrounds, so too have violent extremists and terrorists penetrated our cyber domain to ply their evil and sinful trade. Our communities must be vigilant for those cyber activities and defeat the efforts of those who would seek to do us harm. Finally, there is the principle that can guide each and every one of us, regardless of our faith, that we never forget the core values of diversity and tolerance and trust that define all of us as Americans. Each of us in our own lives has many identities. I am at once a son, a husband, a father, a Virginian, a Catholic, a public servant. As students, you are at once a son or a daughter or a brother or a sister, a Muslim, a student. Each of us at times may struggle with our different identities. I know I do. Others may try to get us to focus narrowly on the identities that seem to separate us, but we can never lose sight of the identities that unite us. We are all Americans, and therefore we all share a common purpose. We are a nation of faith, founded by men and women who came here to escape religious persecution, and have since been joined by believers of every faith. We are a nation of liberty, dedicated to the proposition that all men and women are created equal. Just as I am the son of an immigrant, we are a nation of immigrants, constantly renewed and strengthened by new arrivals from every country and culture every day. We are a nation of progress, where rights and justice have been expanded when we come together across color, creed, and faith to demand change. As the president said in Cairo, there are those who say that Muslims and non-Muslims are somehow fated to disagree, that as individuals we must somehow choose among our many identities, that different civilizations are doomed to clash. Of course, that myth is belied by more than 200 years of American history and American success. And it is belied by those of you in this room, Americans who know that our identities of faith and citizenship are not exclusive of one another. They're mutually reinforcing. On the contrary, religion and nationality strengthen and reinforce each other as well as America itself. And anyone who doubts this truth need only look to recent events in Haiti. Amidst so much suffering, we saw man's inherent goodness. People came together from many nations and faiths, Christian and Jew, Muslim, Sikh, and Hindu, for a single purpose, to help other human beings in crisis. And I couldn't help but think, as I watched that footage, how much it stood in stark contrast to the blood and the suffering and the deaths that have been perpetrated by extremist organizations. The effort in Haiti included physicians and relief works from the Islamic Medical Association of North America, Islamic Relief, and the Zakat Foundation. As one of those volunteers said, we are commanded by our Creator to help a fellow man indeed. It's very clear in the Quran that to save one human life is as if you saved all of humanity. I can't imagine a more inspiring lesson for all of us. And as we work together here at home to keep our country safe, as we work together around the world to build a safer and more secure future for our children, I think this is something that has brought us together today, but it cannot last just for today. And again, I want to sincerely thank you from the bottom of my heart for giving me the opportunity to speak to you here today. Thank you very much.